This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. Today, my guest will be Scott Hewler, a journalist and writer from North Carolina. He's currently working for Duke University with their Alumni and Public Relations magazine, and he has written a book entitled A Delicious Country, Rediscovering the Carolinas Along the Route of John Lawson's 1700 Expedition. Scott, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
First of all, why don't you tell our folks about John Lawson and why you, an adopted North Carolinian, decided to make this trek?
Well, Lawson is, when I'm speaking in person, I like to tell people that what we know for sure about Lawson is he was basically some guy. That's really all we know specifically. People have done all kinds of biographical sketches of Lawson, but they're mostly based on vapor. We have very, very little actual records of Lawson. We do know that he showed up in 1700 in Charleston, what is now South Carolina, and for reasons that we really still don't know to this day, undertook this two-month journey through what is now South and North Carolina, and wrote a book about it and all kinds of other observations that he made through the Carolinas. And that book is incredibly important. It gives us sketches of the Indians that we have only from Lawson's voice. It gives us descriptions of the flora, the fauna, the geography of the Carolinas. He's this marvelous observer, and we know almost nothing about him. I stumbled on Lawson when I was doing another book, and I was trying to trace the history of my particular piece of land in Raleigh. I wanted to trace it all the way back to the Lord's proprietors, the eight guys who used to own the Carolinas in its earliest days. And I tried a variety of methods of doing that and failed. But I learned about this guy, Lawson, who had walked through my region, who had walked through central North Carolina in 1700, you know, really when the Tuscarora still owned that territory. And I thought, okay, well, let me get his book. And then where's the book that somebody wrote that takes Lawson's observation and spikes it down into modern places? Like Lawson describes this, and here's what it looks like now. Lawson describes it, and here's what it looks like now. I thought that would give me a good sense of what my territory would have looked like in 1700. And it turned out that book did not exist. And as you can well understand, that's a pretty exciting moment in the life of a writer when there's a book out there that you need and no one else has written it. And, you know, sort of the heavens open up and you know what your next undertaking is going to be. And so one thing led to another, and I eventually did get to do exactly what I hoped to do, which was exactly what Lawson did. I started in Charleston and made my way bit by bit through in this sort of big modified sea through the Carolinas and ended up in what you or I would call Little Washington, North Carolina, but what I suppose the Indians in those days called the place where that British guy lives with his daughter.
One thing we do know about Lawson is he was English, a native of England. Other than his arrival in Carolina, there's a lot of speculation about connection with the Royal Society, that kind of thing, right?
Right. Lawson, as we understand it, there's been a lot of biographical sketches, mostly hopeful biographical sketches because they don't know for sure. But we think that he was a young man from London and probably had connections in Yorkshire and might have been known to the most, to sort of the highest level of society in England. And he was looking, we think he went to college at Gresham College, which is where in the late 1600s, the Royal Society was creating itself. And my belief is that Lawson looked at those members of the Royal Society the way Mark Twain looked at steamboat pilots or people of my generation looked at astronauts. And that Lawson had a look at that and he was like, oh, I'll have that. Let me be part of that. That sounds amazing. I'll do that. And he was clearly looking for something to do. He was looking for a way to start to make his name for himself. And he says in his book that he was thinking of going to the Grand Jubilee in Rome in 1700, which was basically a big state fair that the Pope threw every 25 years to give people something to do. And he describes meeting somebody in London who dissuaded him from going to Rome and said, you know, I think Lawson quotes him as saying Carolina was the best place to go to. And I like to think of it as somebody putting his arm around his shoulders and saying, well, you know, you could go to Rome, but isn't Rome kind of 17th century? The 18th century is all happening over in North America. Come along with me, like the fox putting his arm around Pinocchio. And Lawson took his invitation, jumped on a ship, and made his way to Charleston.
Might there also have been something political, because in the late 17th century, Roman Catholicism was in very bad odor in England, and the fact that he talked about going to Rome would have raised all sorts of red flags.
Yeah, I suppose that's possible. And certainly the first group of settlers that he describes staying with on his journey are French Huguenots, who were Protestants who left France when they were being persecuted and settled in the Carolinas. And he's very comfortable with the Huguenots and writes about them very kindly.
Okay. Well, he, for whatever reason, scientific or just the love of adventure because it's out there, he arrives in Charleston in 1700. And his description of it could be easily translated into 21st century terms by any chamber of commerce.
Yeah, that's right. He describes it as a place with good roads and a growing business community, and all the right tutors were there so your kids would get a good education. He describes Charleston just the way, as you said, any modern chamber of commerce would describe their region, a place that we've got everything that you need. Your business can thrive. There's good land here. You can make some money. You can send your kids to school. It's got great quality of life. That's the buzzword that we use now, right? And Lawson was saying in 1700 that Charleston had great quality of life. I mean, it only had, you know, between 1,500 and 2,000 people, but that made it one of the bigger cities in colonial North America. So it was a thriving and growing place.
And it would be continue to be one of the biggest colonial American cities till after the Revolution. And interestingly, his description, within 4 years after his visit to Charleston, South Carolina begins to have a favorable balance of trade with England, which is not what a colony is supposed to do. And so, yes, he is coming to South Carolina that's right on the cusp. Charleston's becoming a major port of the empire, not just of North America. And the trade patterns are incredible. So his observation there, that picture of Charleston is not captured very much by Ash or others who talk about South Carolina. They're interested in flora and fauna, but he really had a discerning eye for whatever environment he found himself in.
Yeah, he's, I've heard him called a great noticer, which is a phrase that comes from Dr. Doolittle, of all things. But he really was. He described what he saw, and I found him as a writer. You know, he's in the North Carolina Literary Hall of Fame, and not for nothing. He really deserves that. His turn of phrase is just beautiful, and he observes not just, as you say, flora and fauna. He writes about the people that he meets. And Lawson is astonishing, not just in his capacity for descriptive writing, but in his respect for the Native Americans, for the Indian tribes he meets. He treats them as fully human people, as people worthy of respect and admiration. And he clearly does respect, admire, and love them. And we have stories about the Indian tribes from Lawson that we have from no other sources at all. It's such a great resource that Lawson gives us this record of the Carolinas just at this sort of knife-edge moment when the colony was really beginning to assert itself, as you say, and the past was suddenly beginning to really recede, and what was coming in the future, nobody could know. And so Lawson tells us these stories. He describes the Indian. He describes their eating, their hunting, their dancing, their rituals, their funerals. It's astonishing, the record that Lawson leaves us about the Indian tribes.
And he even describes their punishment of enemies, and there's a fair amount of discussion on how Lawson himself met his fate.
Yeah, that's right. Lawson describes in great kind of lurid detail one of the ways that the Indians would torture to death their prisoners. He describes taking little splinters of pitch pine that they would poke all over a person, and then they would set them on fire, and the person would kind of burn like a candle and be forced to dance around the fire while the tribe, you know, gloried in the death of their enemy. And late in his life, in 1711, when Lawson was continuing to explore, he was going up the what's now the Contentnea Creek from what's Grifton now, probably looking for a way, a better path to the Tidewater in Virginia, which is something that people of those days were always trying to do, is find a better trade route. And he and his party stumbled onto a war party of Tuscaroras who were about to attack the British colonies on the coast, and they were captured, and the others were let go. Lawson was killed. We're not exactly sure how he was killed, but one of the ways that it's been discussed is that he suffered that torture with the pitch pine needles in his skin. And I think people like to believe that's how he died because he describe this torture, and people find that so amazing, and the irony is kind of pleasing. We do know he was killed. We're not sure exactly how he was killed.
Well, the irony is Lawson, who greatly respected the Indians and understood them, met that fate. That would also happen in South Carolina with Samuel Carne and others who had official dealings with the Native Americans. But when in South Carolina, whether it was the Catawba or the Creek, decided to go to war, if you were a European in Indian territory, your chances of surviving were pretty slim.
Right. Well, and Lawson, even though he stumbled into this war party, it's fair to say that once the Tuscarora decided that their only hope was to fight, that they could no longer get along with these expanding English colonies, Lawson would have had a target on his back anyway, because, yes, he was absolutely respectful to the Indians. He was almost alone in his voice of treating them with admiration and respect. Just the same, that didn't stop him from acquiring land from them, from developing that land, from bringing more settlers over. He wasn't helping them. He may have been nice to them and respected them, but he wasn't really helping their long-term prospects. On the other hand, I did meet the vice chief of the Santee tribe, a woman named Peggy Scott, and she said to me, Lawson gave me my history back, that she described growing up in South Carolina in the third group in a binarily segregated culture where she would go to school and there would be like a drinking fountain for the white kids and kind of a poor quality drinking fountain for the black kids. And if an Indian child needed a drink of water, the principal would have to go and bring it to her in a paper cup. So she described that sense of like that she barely existed. And then when she was in college, she stumbled onto Lawson and she read his book. And with his description of the Santee, of the Siwi, of these tribes with such admiration and such decency. And she said, it was like Lawson gave me my history back. I will never forget that.
And you delve into this in the modern day. In South Carolina, there's only one federally recognized tribe, and that is the Catawba. There are state-recognized tribes, but it's that federal recognition that the Santee, the PD, and others are still trying to claim. The Lumbee in North Carolina.
Right. The Lumbee, the Okanichee, all of these tribes would love recognition, but it's a maze and it's a madness for them to try to do it.
All right. You discovered this book in your research of, and I found that interesting, that you really wanted to find out what your land was like, your own land was like 300 years ago. And so you read the book, and then like Lawson, you got a hair and decided you wanted to explore.
That's exactly right. And I wanted to do this. And, you know, on the one hand, obviously, that would be so much fun. How cool would that be? But on the other hand, being fair both to a publisher that I would want to support me and to readers who I'd want to read this book, what's the point? You know, I can see why it would be fun to do, but really, what's the point? And one of the points is we get from science. You know, the famous Grinnell transects of Yosemite out in California. When they did that in the early part of the 1900s, they said the reason we're doing this is so we have a record of what's out there. And then 100 years from now, people can compare what's out there now. And 100 years later, you know, early in the 21st century, people are retracing the Grinnell transects, and they are comparing what's out there, what was there then, what's there now. We look back at, for example, Thoreau's records of flowering and budding of plants, and we're able to compare it and say, okay, how has the climate changed? You know, spring comes a week and a half earlier now. We know this from Thoreau. Aldo Leopold, who wrote his Hand County Almanac, people are doing the same thing, going back to his observations. So I thought, well, there's some real benefit to that. If we take Lawson as the early observations, and then I go and I retrace and I make observations again, we can do comparison and we can see what's going on. And so I was able to say, okay, this is a valuable enterprise, not just a cool, fun road trip for me. This is something really worth doing. And so I started reaching out and got publishers interested, but an enterprise like this is a lot of money and a lot of to-do-ins. And what finally made it possible for me to do it was MIT has the Knight Science Journalism Fellowships. And I got one of those, and that paid for me to undertake this project, to build the website that has supported this project. And then I spent a little time in Cambridge, too. So the MIT Knight Science Journalism Fellowships enabled me to get out there and literally walk the walk.
Okay. And paddle the, just walk, but you had to paddle too. All right. You start out in Charleston, and the Charleston waterfront where you started out, what anything like in terms of geography, what Lawson would have seen, because everything from East Bay towards the Ashley River is, I mean, the Cooper River is fill land.
Right.
East Bay was the waterfront. It's, you know, over the last three centuries, it's been filled in. And the Great Wall, part of, you know, Charleston was a walled city.
Right. I look back at those old drawings, and it's amazing to see how the coast has changed. And yet, on the, I guess it would be the east edge of Charleston into the river, there were docks sticking out. Mm-hmm. And it was very satisfying to me to get in my canoe one morning on a dock on the east side of Charleston, not exactly where it would have been for Lawson, but to do the same thing he did, was to get into this canoe and paddle my way across the harbor. And it was a really thrilling moment. And what's interesting is that when Lawson went, he went in a canoe with nine other people, which means we need to really stretch our mind around the concept of canoe. It would have been a cypress trunk that was big enough to carry 10 people and all the supplies they needed. That's an astonishingly large craft. And one of the first things I learned, or I think I learned, from my canoe trip up the, you know, I took the Intracoastal Waterway, which didn't exist in Lawson's day. But by the end of the first day of canoeing, I really cared only about two things while I was canoeing: which direction is the wind blowing and which direction is the current flowing? Because paddling upwind and paddling up current was killing me. And Lawson, who complains about everything, he complains when he's cold, he complains when he's wet, he complains about the bugs, he complains when he's hungry, he complains about the food. I would have loved to travel with Lawson. We would have complained about everything together. But Lawson never says, man, do I have blisters. He never says, boy, I'll tell you what, when we're paddling against current, I sure hate that. So my belief is that Lawson never paddled that canoe. I think of him sitting in the back taking notes while all these other people are paddling. And like Eustace Tilley on the cover of The New Yorker, looking through his magnifying glass or a monocle and scratching down his little notes. And I love thinking of Lawson as this kind of, he was just getting over. He was just having his little adventure and letting other people do the heavy lifting.
Hey, he is the stereotypical out there and letting the natives do the paddling, right?
No, that's exactly right. He let the Indians do the paddling, and I think the traders that he was with were probably hauling some water too, but Lawson was just taking notes, and I love that concept.
All right, you set out from Charleston by canoe. Are you by yourself?
Not quite. I'm alone in the canoe, and I have a kayak paddle so that I can really manage the craft. I'm a longtime canoer. I'm good with canoes. But I am not alone. I have a guide, just like Lawson. Lawson is in a canoe full of people who knew where he's going, and he's just the baggage. He's just following along. I reached out to a woman named Kathy Livingston, Charlestonian, and who lives in the Charleston area, and she ran an enterprise called Nature Adventure Outfitters. And I called her up, and I said, I'd like to rent a canoe, please. And she said, well, okay, what's your idea? And I told her all this stuff, and she said, I got this. And she put me in a canoe, and she got me a guide every single day, somebody who knew the flora, the fauna, who knew the wildlife, somebody who knew the terrain, who knew the culture. And she found me a place to stay four nights in a row. As I made my way up the waterway, I stayed on Goat's Island one night. I stayed on Capers Island a couple nights, visited Bull's Island. Then I stayed in the Buck Hall campsite and then stayed on the front porch of someone, a friend of Kathy's. And it was that kind of trip. I loved that sense of you just go where you go and you stay where you stay and you see what you see. And that felt very Lawsonian to me. Lawson, in fact, was just... You know, as I said, there's a lot of questions about exactly who he was and things like that. And I was trying to describe it when I finished my kayaking project, and we came up to the state park. Is it Hampton Park?
It's Hampton Plantation.
Right.
Archibald Rutledge's home. It is a state park.
Right. We came up to Hampton Plantation, and a bunch of archaeologists were there, and they knew we were coming, and so they came out to meet us. And one of these young archaeologists was asking me about Lawson and tell me what he was doing. And I said, well, we're not quite sure why he was doing it. He was a young guy. He was probably about 25. And she said, oh, he was taking a gap year. I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And then I was saying, and then he was kind of going from place to place and just, can I stay here? He'd just kind of show up in town with his trading partners, and they'd go like, hey, anybody got anything to eat? Any place we can sleep? And she said, he was couch surfing. I was like, I'm understanding how Lawson, you're telling me things that I couldn't figure out on my own. That was very thrilling. But it had that sort of just road trip feeling, both for Lawson and for me, too, I think.
You mentioned the Intercoastal Waterway, and obviously that's a change from the landscape that Lawson would have seen. But actually, very early on, South Carolinians made what they call cuts. They would connect creeks with the river. They would connect creeks with one another, changing the whole flow of the water in the Carolina Lowcountry. And that kept on for almost 100 years. The fields of cordgrass of Spartina, that's your first chapter. In fact, Spartina mon amour is what you fell in love with that, right?
I fell deeply in love with Spartina, and it's this a remarkable plant it's creating land. It's basically making mud as it moves forward, and it protects the land. You know, ask the people of New Orleans how they like no longer having their salt marsh out in front of their city. And it is this incredibly beautiful plant that goes, you know, 3, 4, 5 feet above the water, and my canoe would brush up against it and make this beautiful, beautiful susurration. And while I was in the waterway, it was beautiful to look at. When we would get into the little tidal creeks, there were times where I was paddling and I thought, I can see canoe, I can see paddle, I can see Spartina alterniflora, and I can see sky. And for all that I can see, this could be 1700 rather than 2014. When I was paddling. And that sense of here I am out in the world, out in the water, just seeing what's out there. I loved that feeling that it could have been 1700. So yeah.
Just like Lawson, you had a guide because you're in there in one of those little tidal creeks. You can't see anywhere else. You don't know where you're going.
Oh, absolutely. No, there were places that my guides took me, that like we went to see the seaweed shell ring. I could have paddled by the little creek entrance that leads you off the waterway into the seaweed shell ring 400 times and never noticed the entry myself. And so I loved that. And at the end of each day, my guide would usually paddle away and go wherever he or she had made arrangements to be picked up. And they would say, okay, here's where you're going to go, and here's what you're looking for, and here's, and, you know, take a right, take a left, here's where the campsite is, you'll find yourself, you'll find your spot, don't worry. And so for an hour or so, I'd be paddling on my own. And I'm a full-grown man, but every time I found a campsite, I felt like I had climbed Mount Everest because I was paddling in that trackless, you know, marsh, and I was finding a spot that I needed to find. I felt like I had really accomplished something, and that was night after night. That canoe trip was just thrilling.
Well, you mentioned the seaweed shell mound, and there it's not just that you discovered, but you run into South kind of characters like Billy Baldwin.
Billy Baldwin, I call him the poet laureate of McClellanville. And, you know, he's just a writer and poet of the first water. He's absolutely terrific. And he and his friends go kayaking every Thursday morning, I think. And so they came and met me at the Buckhall campground, and we paddled off together. And Billy's sitting there like in dress pants and dress socks and dress shoes, you know, in a big hat. And we're paddling along, and I look back to talk to Billy for something, and he's got his feet out of the way you do when you're kayaking or canoeing. Sometimes you just dangle your feet in the water. That's Billy, and he's just amazing. He was so much fun to talk to, and he said one of the most incredible things. He told me a story about one of his friends hearing about Lawson's death, and as you and I were discussing, we're not exactly sure how he died, but he died in some gruesome way. And Billy said, a friend of his said, he was a land developer and he got what they all deserve.
Well, you mentioned he was bringing settlers into North Carolina. He also is responsible for founding two North Carolina cities, right?
Right. North Carolina's two first incorporated cities, Bath and New Bern, both were laid out by Lawson, who was a surveyor, and Lawson was one of the founders. So my belief is that North Carolina should treat Lawson the way Pennsylvania treats William Penn. The history of North Carolina is tied up with Lawson, and, you know, yet nobody really knows about him. I had never heard of him until I stumbled across his book while I was doing research.
Well, in earlier North Carolina histories, he's not mentioned as much as the folks who sort of seeped down from Virginia into North Carolina, the one that William Byrd discovered. Scott, we've got to pause for a moment to let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Scott Hewler about his book, A Delicious Country, Rediscovering John Lawson's Journey Through the Carolinas. Where did you end your paddling and stay straight on the land?
Right. We ended the paddling at Hampton Plantation, and I was glad to do it because, like Lawson, I found paddling upstream hard and unpleasant. And so then I would go for 2 or 3 days at a time and take trips. We went through the Francis Marion National Forest, where we saw those cypress tupelo swamps right out of Central Casting. That was incredible. Made our way up through past the two lakes, Lake Moultrie and Lake Marion, where lakes should not be, and dealt with the people there who talked about how all those changes had affected their history, and went to the top of the lookout at Poinsett State Park and looked at what Lawson called the most amazing prospect he had seen since he came to North America, continued north, and then continued following up, you know, where the Watery and the Congaree joined to form the Santee. We followed up the Watery, just like Lawson had done, went through Camden, went through Lancaster, and made our way up to Charlotte, where we met with people from the Catawba tribe.
The Catawba and the Native American Studies program at USC Lancaster and their museum is really something. It's off the beaten path, but it's well worth going to see.
And they were incredibly kind to me. They supported me. They introduced me to people. I gave a brief speech there one evening. They were so incredibly nice to me. Chris Judge and Brent Burgeon, and they really looked out for me. It was one of the many, many places where I felt like this is just like Lawson's journey, where I'm showing up places and the people who know things are introducing me to people and the people who understand things are sharing that and they're looking out for me. I just felt like the people, especially in Lancaster, really could not have been kinder.
Well, you go to Charlotte, but you camp out at the Charlotte Motor Speedway.
Yes, and I don't know that I've ever spent a more fun and weird night camping than at the Charlotte Motor Speedway. I'm a longtime lover of NASCAR, and I think NASCAR reached me in the same way that Lawson did, and there's a kind of cultural anthropology going that you can learn so much from understanding this culture. So when I saw that Lawson would have walked right by the Speedway, I knew I had to camp at the Speedway. And they were even having racing the night that I went through. It was just, you know, it wasn't like enormous cup level racing, but they were having, you know, one of their, I think, Wednesday night, you know, like little quarter mile track races. And I sat there in the stands and eating, you know, I think it was a fried bologna sandwich, and watching, looking out and seeing the hills recede into the distance. I thought, this is exactly where Lawson would have been, and what he describes looking at the hills there. And I think this was the part where I think Lawson really fell in love with the Piedmont. I think that that's when he started to see what a beautiful place North and South Carolina were.
And of course, he had also reached highlands after he left Camden, what we now call the High Hills of the Santee. Cook's Mountain, it's in Richland County, it's near Columbia. Right. It's near where the paper plant is.
Oh, right. Yeah, I think he could see that from the prospect. And one of the park rangers who I spoke with said that you could see Cook's Mountain from there if you kind of cleared some of the trees, but he didn't want to do that because you would also see the paper plant. And he was making a sort of decision. I'd like you to see the mountain, but if seeing the mountain means you can see the paper plant, I'd rather that you didn't see either one.
Okay. So I brought you back briefly to South Carolina, but you moved on into North Carolina after visiting with the Catawbas. And as we mentioned that earlier, of all the Indian peoples in the two Carolinas, they're the only ones that have federal recognition. And that's quite a story, and we can't take a segue from that because that's about two shows in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. The Catawba story is astonishing.
You're at the Charlotte Motor Speedway. You spend the night there. Then where do you go?
Well, we made our way up. At that point, you're really on the trading path, and the trading path is so important in that if you look at I-85, I-85 follows the trading path. One of the things I learned is about a concept I call roadness, where people, animals, have been trying to get from place to place since the very beginning. And so the path that you follow will make some kind of sense. It will be on the spot where, even when in the rainiest parts, it doesn't get marshy. It will be between the good pass between the hills and the good ford across the river. A path will make sense to you. And so the Indians had been using the trading path for centuries, and then that's where the settlers started to follow, and that's where the railroad followed, and then that's where the interstate followed. And so I was following that path, and we got up to Salisbury before too long. And Salisbury was an amazing spot to stop because you have the trading ford there and you have all kinds of Indian heritage and all kinds of settlers' heritage. And I talked to all these people. And then when I was leaving, I stopped and talked to a couple of African-American guys on a porch. And they said, well, before you leave, don't miss the hanging tree. And I said, what? And they said, the hanging tree, Google it, look up Salisbury lynching. And if you go over to a specific spot, that the tree where that occurred still exists. And I did the Googling, and I did go, and I went, and I'm not sure that we can believe that any specific tree is the tree where this terrible lynching occurred in the early 1900s, but I found that so vital to remember to talk to everybody, because I had stayed and I had learned a lot from the people in Salisbury who were very kind to me and talked to me about all kinds of historical aspects, but nobody mentioned that lynching. And that was a really important moment for me to make sure that I got every voice into this book, because these lynchings are an important part of our modern history, and we have to keep that in mind. We can't forget it.
It's interesting, the jump from 1700 to 2014. In Salisbury, you deal with issues in the early 20th century.
And then as I continued, we're now dealing with with very modern issues, which is that I think I mentioned that Lawson walked through at a time when the world was on a knife edge, when 50 years previously, the Native American cultures had been functioning as they had for centuries, and 50 years later, nobody could have predicted what it would have looked like in the Carolinas. And I was walking through, and he talks about coming to Indian settlements that are abandoned, that are emptied. He talks about meeting tribes who are trying to find out how we're going to take the remnants of two or three different tribes, put them together so that we can at least have some sort of stability. And I was walking through small towns that were all but abandoned. And I was over and over, as I walked along the highways, I would find a house just being subsumed by nature again, the house slowly collapsing and falling back into the earth. And I thought, this is the same thing. I'm seeing the end of something. Lawson understood that. He describes that there can't be one-sixth as many natives as there had been even 50 years ago, and that the place felt empty to him. He understood that he was at the ragged end of something, that he wasn't seeing the Indian cultures as they had been. He was seeing them after smallpox, after rum, after dispossession, after slavery. He was seeing them then, and I felt like I was walking through these small towns that 50 years ago was post-war prosperity and factory jobs and farming jobs, and there was all kinds of stuff going on. Not now. And 50 years from now, who could even imagine what our culture will look like, what our countryside will look like, what our communities will look like? So I felt like, just like Lawson, I ended up walking out through this culture that's on a knife edge and a moment of complete uncertainty.
And you're talking really about small town Carolinas, both, because in Lancaster, with the closing of Springs Mills, it was something that people never envisioned would ever happen. But you also talk about, you mentioned the house, nature reclaiming it. One of the ways nature's reclaiming it is with a plant introduced into the Carolinas that Lawson would never have seen, kudzu.
Right. And, you know, and I even did some research on kudzu. People are trying to figure out how to eat kudzu right now. They're, you know, kudzu's with us. We better get used to it. But one of the things I learned about kudzu is that we all, you know, drive by it on the interstates and we see these moonscapes of telephone poles and everything eaten alive by kudzu. But one of the points that I have seen when scientists are talking about invasive plants that they're worried about, they rarely mention kudzu because kudzu doesn't spread except by its rhizomes. It doesn't spread through the air. So where you plant the kudzu, yeah, it spreads like crazy, but you can just cut it back and that stops it. And so in some ways, kudzu has kind of done exactly what they wanted it to do, which was stabilize some of the land. And, you know, where the farms destroyed it, the kudzu will at least keep the earth sitting there. Now, it does spread like crazy where it's been planted, but it's not like it's going on the wind and taking over the entire, you know, it's not taking over farms and things like that.
Scott, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Scott Hewler about his book, A Delicious Country, in which Scott retraces John Lawson's 1700 expedition through the Carolinas. Were you your own photographer on this trip?
I was, and that was one of my favorite things, is that from the start of this project, I thought, I want to live tweet this because I want the word to get out. I think Lawson would have used Instagram and Twitter had they been available to him. He was trying to impress the Royal Society. He was trying to make a name for himself in this new sort of burgeoning scientific community, and so he would have used these tools. The best thing about it, I love shooting images, and carrying my phone, I could update the people paying attention to my journey on the website, on Instagram, on Twitter, constantly. And so I loved the sense that I was sharing where I was and what I was seeing with people as it happened. The images, people have liked them a lot. We're going to have a museum exhibition of artifacts from the journey, and Lawson and me, and a lot of Instagram images will be there. That'll be in the City of Raleigh Museum in October. But I loved sharing those images, and they would bring me people back, people would reach out to me and say, hey, I saw that you're doing this. Would you be interested in talking about this or that or the other thing? And I thought, yes, I would very much like to do that. And I loved the response to that, that I was able to then do what Lawson did, is meet the people who lived in the region and who would then help me in one way or the other, or meet me or discuss things with me in one way or the other. And those images were so powerful. Instagram was my best friend by far.
This is a logistical question. You've got tents, you've got all this equipment. Are you hiking all this time? How are you getting all of this equipment around?
That's a great question. I was hiking, and what I would do is I would make friends constantly. I called them heroes of the Lawson Trek. Somebody would meet me, and like I would leave my car where I planned to finish. And then somebody would drive me, 30 or 40 miles back to where I had finished my last trek. And then I would hike my way north or east, west, whatever I was doing. Now, one of the things, sometimes I slept in tents, I slept in parks, I slept in a church pew, I slept on people's front porches, I slept in the basement of a stately house. I slept anywhere I could. And one night, actually, I did something that I found so powerful. I didn't even care what the land was. I just said, I'm going to walk until I get tired, then I'm going to look around, and I'm going to find a place where I'm not in anybody's way, I'm not in someone's yard, and I found a little copse of trees. I set up my tent, I lay down at night, and then I got out of my tent in the morning, packed up my tent, and walked along. I don't know whose land it was. I don't know anything about it. I was in a little copse of trees. Nobody would have seen my tiny little gray tent, and that was very satisfactory to me in a way that I almost don't understand, but that I was able to just walk the earth, lay my body down, get up in the morning and walk again. That was really fun. I enjoyed that sense of, just like Lawson, you're tired, that looks like a good spot, let's make camp and see what's going on. And now I also on occasion stayed in hotels, stayed with friends. I did just like what Lawson did, like what my archaeologist friend said. I was couch surfing. I made my way, and I stayed where I could.
All right. You also ran into a tropical storm.
It wasn't a tropical storm, but it was a big storm. I will say that when I was out on Capers Island, there was a storm that came through. And as we were talking about the instantaneous documentation of it, I took a minute or so of film of, my tent, basically collapsing in on itself and then blowing back out when the wind would recede and then collapsing back in on itself. And I shared that. I just thought that was so much fun that I was right out here on the coast, right in the teeth of this wind. And a lot of stuff got wet that night. But the next morning, the night before, I had tilted the canoe over my stuff and just figured I'd ride it out. The next morning, I laid the wet things out in the sun, and it was maybe an hour and a half later than I usually started, and I was in the canoe and moving my way across. And one of the fun things is that Lawson discusses a famous hurricane that hit in September of 1705, in 1700, I'm sorry. And he describes eating some of the provisions from the Rising Sun, which was a ship that had been destroyed during the storm, and the people had scavenged the supplies, and he describes being served those supplies. And then later he describes walking through an area where the trees have been just destroyed down to matchsticks, and you and I and everybody in the Carolinas has similar stories. We all have our hurricane stories. And so Lawson had his hurricane story. When I was moving my way through the South Carolina coast, of course, it was Hugo's stories that I heard from every single person that I met. And so Lawson, people who live there, and now even I had my coastal storm story.
How long did your journey take?
Well, it took a little more than a year for me, or almost exactly a year for me to do the entire thing. As I said, Lawson was young guy. The nearest person who really knew him well was 5,000 miles away. It didn't bother anybody for Lawson to disappear one day and then pop up 2 months later, and nobody knew where he was. I have Mini Mites basketball games to manage and Sunday school carpool, so I had to go a few days at a time. But it was, a few days every week or two, and it took the better part of a year. I started my canoeing in October October of 2014 and finished in late September of 2015. And then the people in Bath invited me to have a sort of triumphant entry into Bath by canoe just after that. And I loaded my kids into a canoe and we almost got swept away once again. But then we eventually paddled into Bath as our sort of ceremonial finish of the journey.
Well, you mentioned that there's now going to be an exhibit of souvenirs or artifacts you picked up along the way.
Right, artifacts and maps and a sense of what Lawson's journey was, what my journey was, and how the two compared, and how, you know, to take Lawson's old map, you know, the map that came out in Lawson's book, and show on that map what the journey looks like, and then to take a modern map and show on that map what it looks like, to compare, to do the comparison job that we've talked about from the start, and to share some of the things that I found. Lawson gathered specimens, botanical specimens, and sent them to the great collectors of the day in London. So that was flora, that was fauna, that was, you know, occasionally bird skins and things like that. What I gathered were my feathers and the occasional plant, but also like highway reflectors and railroad spikes and the constant tide of Bud Light cans squashed by the side of the road, you know? And that has just as much meaning because these are the artifacts of the world I walked through, and Lawson gathered the artifacts of the world he walked through, and the comparison is instructive.
We talked about Billy Baldwin and other people. Who was the favorite character you met en route?
Oh, there were so many. I would say two people. One was Val Green, who is he's actually a sewer engineer, but 40 years ago, his wife at the time gave him a copy of Lawson, and he started to read about it, and it sounded very interesting to him. And he got interested in figuring out where Lawson had gone. And started doing the math, I would say. Just started, okay, the prospect, the most amazing prospect, well, that's got to be Poinsett State Park because, you know, given where he started, given how many days he's walked, and given what he describes, it's got to be there. And then he's able to go a couple, you know, a day or so back, and he describes these two creeks. Well, Val went back and figured out these creeks. In any case, Val told me pretty much step by step where Lawson had gone. And without Val, I would never have been able to accomplish what I did on this project. And Val was just so helpful. And he would just roar up behind me in his pickup truck periodically while I was on the trek because he was looking out for me. A person who I just met on the trek was a guy named John Jeffries, also called Blackfeather, of the Okanichis, who lives up in Hillsboro in North Carolina. And he invited me to his home and showed me just artifacts and artifacts and arrowheads that he found and arrowheads that he's made. And he said to me, people say, well, which ones are authentic? And he said, they're all authentic because I'm an Okanichi and the ones who were made 400 years ago by Okanichis, it's the same. They're Okanichi arrowheads. And that was so powerful to me that he's not confused by that. That just because it's old, that doesn't mean it's more valuable. The Okanichi still exist, and John was there to share their history with me and to welcome me into his home. And when it was time to shake hands, he shook my left hand. He said, the left hand is closer to the heart. And that was beautiful. And Lawson describes a greeting that the Indians use where when they meet each other, they scratch one another on the shoulder. And he said, this is a mark of great respect. And so when John shook my hand in an unusual way that felt in some way like a similar experience of that scratching on the shoulder. And I felt I was moved by that.
You have a portrait that may or may not be Lawson in your book. You mentioned that there were some Lawson aficionados, groupies.
The Lawsonians, I call them.
The Lawsonians.
And Keats Sparrow, who was an English professor at East Carolina. You want to talk about a guy who was born to be an English professor. It would have to be Keats Sparrow. And Keats found Lawson, fell in love with Lawson, was interested in Lawson. And he, in traveling in England, one time somebody pointed out to him a portrait that they said might be John Lawson. And there are a lot of things. We have no other images of Lawson, so we have nothing to compare it with. But it was painted at about the same time that Lawson would have been there. He would have been in England in 1709 to print his book, and that's when he was made Surveyor General of the colony. And that's when they think the portrait was from. The portrait was done in the style of the Godfrey Kneller, who painted a lot of members of the Royal Society. Whether it was by Kneller or not, we don't know. But there's a lot that seems to say this could be the John Lawson that we want it to be, and we're all very straightforward that we want this portrait to be to be authentic, and so we hope it is, but we can't be sure. But it's there. Sparrow had it. His widow has it now, and she allowed me to take pictures of it and put it in the book. And it may not be Lawson, but to me, it's Lawson enough, and it's that face I think of now when I conjure Lawson in my mind.
All right, Scott, I hate to say this, but Alfred's giving me the wind-up sign. Any last words for our listeners before we sign off?
Well, I just hope that this book brings Lawson to more people. His journey was so important for North and South Carolina, and I hope people, I hope he begins to get the kind of importance in our historical discussions that I believe he deserves. I've really enjoyed speaking with you about him.
All right. Well, Scott Hueler, the author of A Delicious Country, Rediscovering the Carolinas Along the Route of John Lawson's 1700 Expedition. Thanks so much for being with us on The Journal today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. Scott Hueler was an interesting interview. His project of retracing John Lawson's expedition in 1700 in 2014 and comparing history, location, incidents from one century to another made for a fascinating story. But I'd like to remind our listeners that Lawson was just one of many English explorers in the Carolinas, and particularly in South Carolina in the late 17th and early 18th century. And if you want to find more about these folks and even read their journals, go to read Alexander Sally's Narratives of Early Carolina. It was published almost a century ago, but it is a fabulous source of firsthand accounts. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.